Hello, kings and queens of the ring. Welcome back to episode 8 of Arm Drag Takedown with Pollo Del Mar. I am Pollo Del Mar, the world's wrestling-obsessed drag personality, and I'm also a journalist with the Huffington Post. I have covered professional wrestling for the Huffington Post for a number of years and only recently have launched this podcast, which we've long described as pro wrestling with a queer twist. Now, mind you, you do not have to be a member of the LGBTQ community to enjoy my commentary on this. Hopefully, my opinions and point of view will have an appeal across the gender and sexuality spectrums. This is simply my take on professional wrestling as an individual who has long felt that the LGBTQ perspective has been overlooked in professional wrestling. With that aside, let's move forward with a recap of things to come for this episode. Later in this episode, I am joined by former WWE superstar and current Impact Wrestling superstar, Chris Adonis, who many knew during his time with World Wrestling Entertainment as Chris Masters. We take an in-depth look at his career, talk about what is happening currently in WWE, as well as his role in Impact Wrestling, where he has aligned himself with global champion Eli Drake. And he also shares some fun and interesting insight and memories of working with wrestling legends, the likes of Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff, as well as multiple-time NWA World Heavyweight Champion Harley Race. Chris proves to be an interesting and insightful guest, and I hope you will stick around for that. In addition, we take you to a recent conference call that was arranged by Impact Wrestling with the returning Alberto El Patron. As many people saw, Alberto El Patron returned at Bound for Glory, reasserting himself in the global title picture by having an impact, so to speak, on the match between champion Eli Drake and number one contender Johnny Impact. Now, I will not be providing you with the entirety of that interview, which can be found elsewhere on the internet, and I'm going to give you the ins and outs of why I do not like conference calls in just a little bit. But definitely, I have included my questions to Alberto El Patron, as well as some other key questions I think will be of interest to our listeners. All of that and much, much more are going to be ahead on this episode of Arm Drag Takedown with Pollo Del Mar. To never miss an episode of Arm Drag Takedown with Pollo Del Mar, follow our podcast on social media. Like Arm Drag Takedown on Facebook at ADT with PDM. Or follow us on Twitter at ADT with PDM. That's ADT with PDM, Arm Drag Takedown with Pollo Del Mar. Welcome back to Arm Drag Takedown. I am your hostess, Pollo Del Mar, and I want to quickly plug my own Twitter if you are listening and would like to follow all of my thoughts, not just relating to professional wrestling. Please find me on Twitter at The Glamazon PDM, The Glamazon PDM as in Pollo Del Mar, and I would like to let you all know that I had that handle before there was a Beth Phoenix, at least in terms of before Beth Phoenix ever had that moniker in the WWE. So I respect and admire Beth Phoenix. I appreciate her career in WWE and her status as a Hall of Famer, but I am in no way, shape, or form following in her footsteps. I had it first. Now, I want to break from the usual format for this episode. Normally, if you have listened to the previous 7 episodes, you know I give an Arm Drag Takedown, meaning a recap of each and every episode of our television favorites of WWE Raw and SmackDown, as well as Impact Wrestling. But this week, I am going to be breaking from that tradition, albeit a short-lived one, just to give some general recaps and thoughts of things that are happening in the world of professional wrestling. First, I do want to admit that even though I have been hard on Roman Reigns for 7 episodes now, and for years, actually, as a viewer of WWE, I will say and admit that his first promo that he cut as Intercontinental Champion was above average for him. I think that it was average in terms of professional wrestling, but I do think that what he has put out so far as an Intercontinental Champion has been above average. I watched the promo, I actually listened to the promo, and I appreciated what he was able to do. I think that largely the biggest complaint that I have for Roman isn't his in-ring skills. His in-ring skills are perfectly acceptable, but he has a noticeable and notable lack of charisma that I would expect in a championship caliber performer in WWE. I think a tremendous amount of credit needs to go to Elias, his opponent this week on Raw, for actually being so adept in his role as a heel and being so over as a heel in terms of his Who Wants to Walk with Elias and then his terrible singing shtick, that he was able to elicit a strong crowd response for Roman in their match. I think that it was a combination of the perfect storm. Elias is doing very well in his development as a character, and Roman was able to capitalize on that, and in turn, their match on Monday could be a star turn for Elias. I definitely see a bright future in WWE for Elias, and I think that he is a perfect individual to slot into The Miz's role with The Miztourage while Miz is out filming his new WWE film. The Miztourage will have a focus. Elias will continue his development as this somewhat, I don't know, cult-type leader in terms of now having the Miztourage as his supporters. They definitely are walking with Elias at the moment, and I think that things could bode well for Elias in the future. That said, I would like to now turn my attention to other things that are happening in the world of professional wrestling, as I stated earlier, one of which is, and I feel like I'm walking on eggshells here, even bringing this subject matter up. But early in the week, I saw a tweet from Dave Meltzer. Now, Dave Meltzer is obviously one of the foremost voices in professional wrestling, and I bow down to him in terms of his experience and contributions to wrestling as a leader of the foremost voice of what actually is taking place behind the scenes in professional wrestling. He is, bar none, one of the most respected individuals in the industry for what he has contributed outside of the format of professional wrestling industry publications. Publications like Pro Wrestling Illustrated, which I grew up reading, of course, toe the party line. They always maintain kayfabe, and they help tell the stories of professional wrestling in print. Well, Dave Meltzer has been a voice of what is actually happening behind the scenes. He is the creator of the Dirt Sheets. Basically, he is the godfather of many of the wrestling websites that we frequent and visit on a daily basis if you are a fan of wrestling. Things like WrestleZone.com, as well as other sites, would not exist on the internet if not for the Dirt Sheets and for the Wrestling Observer, which was started by Dave Meltzer. Now, with that said, I'm really questioning what Dave Meltzer's idea of a pop culture icon is. Earlier this week, he tweeted that individuals like Ric Flair and Hulk Hogan and others are not pop culture icons. I don't know what his concept of a pop culture icon is, and I saw that other websites and others in the industry took aim at Dave Meltzer for his opinion. Instead of attacking him in any capacity, will simply say that I strongly disagree. For fans of pop music and hip-hop, there is a song currently just outside the U.S. Top 50 and making headways at rap and hip-hop radio around the world titled Ric Flair Drip. It is right now just outside the Top 50, and I cannot imagine that someone who would not qualify as a pop culture icon, an individual who is years beyond his active wrestling career, an individual whose the height of his career came in the 1980s, would still remain so relevant that hip-hop artists and the hip-hop industry, which routinely name-checks Ric Flair, would be able to maintain such staying power if he was not considered a pop culture icon. Hulk Hogan is well beyond his professional wrestling prime, has not been in the industry in an active capacity in years, and still remains a household name. Those individuals of that nature have exceeded and gone well beyond the world of professional wrestling. That is what is an indication that one is a pop culture icon. I would certainly argue that individuals in professional wrestling today do not have that sort of cachet. And in fact, later in my interview with Chris Adonis on this very episode, we talk about that to some degree. But what I would have to argue and strongly disagree with Mr. Meltzer's opinion of Hogan, Flair, Savage, and others of the 80s era not being pop culture icons. Yeah, I have to strongly disagree with you, Mr. Meltzer, because those individuals, for anyone of that era who grew up in it, and or since then even, those names maintain a value that an average professional wrestler of today or even of that generation would not have. So what assisted in that, for people who are not of a certain age to have experienced the 80s wrestling boom at its height and even into the 90s wrestling boom, what allowed for the crossover of professional wrestlers and made them pop culture icons was what was known as the rock and wrestling connection. It was a revolution in professional wrestling where professional wrestling at the onset of the WrestleMania era, many years ago, obviously, combined with pop culture icons of that generation, such as Cyndi Lauper and others. Cyndi Lauper, as everyone probably knows, took professional wrestling imagery and individuals such as Captain Lou Albano and incorporated those people into her hit music videos of the generation. That means that anybody, for example, who saw the music video for Girls Just Want to Have Fun also were exposed to Captain Lou Albano. When Cyndi Lauper appeared at early WrestleManias, the world was talking about that. It was covered by magazines that could not be more mainstream, such as the National Enquirer. So the thought that individuals of that generation would not have made that cultural crossover into pop culture status is highly questionable. I'm not sure how one could justify saying that. Now, was Ric Flair a part of that era in the WWE? Obviously not. But I certainly think that Ric Flair, through his extended career in professional wrestling, did make that crossover. We see that now as he continues forward. It's why people, when you say, woo, know exactly who that reference is. We certainly still see in many other professional sports of today a strong following of WWE as well as professional wrestling among basketball stars, NFL stars, baseball stars. We understand and recognize those individuals. It would be the same to me as saying that somebody like a Larry Bird or a Michael Jordan or Dan Marino, there's huge people who are names within their recognized, even A-Rod, you know, these are people who have crossed over from whatever their respective industry or sports-related industry are and have become cultural, pop culture icons. So, you know, as I said, I thought it was particularly poorly timed to suggest that Ric Flair is not a pop culture icon when he is literally name-checked in the title of a song that is making huge waves in hip-hop and even at pop radio right now. Again, is this something that's particularly newsworthy? Perhaps not, but it's definitely something that has been on my mind throughout the week. And I should note that this weekend, in particular, as a budding personality in the Northern California independent wrestling scene, especially and specifically in San Francisco, this weekend I will be attending the Northern California Wrestling Hall of Fame event in Pacifica, California, where Dave Meltzer will be in attendance and he will be receiving his placement in the Hall of Fame. So ideally, rather than this being a scenario where people, because I saw somebody on Twitter, for example, say that if you're attacking others within the industry, specifically someone of the stature of Dave Meltzer, to gain attention or visibility, then you live a pathetic life. Well, I would certainly never say that that's the case. For myself, I am not attacking. I'm saying that I have a disagreement or a different opinion specifically and exclusively on this matter. I'm not calling into question any of his other contributions, but ideally, this weekend when I cross paths with him in Pacifica, I'll be able to address the issue. I would love to find out his thoughts or the motivation for his thoughts on that particular tweet or series of tweets. Now, I think that there's probably a lot more than goes into any 140 characters or even 280 characters in the expanded Twitter format than he could explain, but I do look forward specifically to asking him about that. I mean, I'll leave choosing five-star matches to Dave Meltzer. I will leave determining who the stars of tomorrow are, per se, to Dave Meltzer. I will leave reporting all of the behind-the-scenes dirt that's happening in the wrestling industry to Dave Meltzer. He is certainly far better qualified to do those things than I am. However, to each of us, we are entitled an opinion, and my opinion is that on this situation and in this situation alone, I would strongly disagree. Ric Flair, you are by all means a pop culture icon. Hulk Hogan, the same. Randy Savage, the same. And hopefully what we will see as the industry progresses is that some of the wrestlers of today will also see the same crossover success that has allowed these men to become pop culture icons and have enduring success long, long after their years in the ring have faded. I do look forward to seeing Dave Meltzer this weekend. I look forward to participating in the NorCal Wrestling Hall of Fame event Sunday in Pacifica, California. I know that there are some big things involved there, and as a strong participant in a local organization that pairs professional wrestling and charity work, which is titled, obviously, Wrestling for Charity, I hope to have a great deal of fun as well as be enlightened by the events of that particular event. It'll be my first time in attendance and my first time as an active participant in such an event, and I'm really anxious and excited to see how that goes. Up next, I would like to give listeners a little insight into some of the things that happen in the world of a professional wrestling journalist. Now, as I mentioned early in this podcast, I have been covering professional wrestling for the Huffington Post for a number of years. Professional wrestling is only one of the categories of celebrities with whom I've worked and covered for Huffington Post. In addition to my work online with Huffington Post, I have placed features in everything from Us Weekly to the San Francisco Chronicle. I've had features in major LGBTQ publications such as The Advocate. And at one point in time, I was contributing to more than 77 publications worldwide. That isn't to inflate my ego for the listeners. It is actually just to illustrate the depth of my work over a course of more than 25 years as a print, media, and online journalist. In the course of more than two decades in the industry, I have reported on and interviewed the likes of Katy Perry, Lady Gaga, Hulk Hogan, Batista, Stone Cold Steve Austin, some of the biggest names in any of their respective industries. And one of the key factors in each of these situations when you are dealing with interviews is the concept of exclusivity. No journalist wants to participate in a scenario wherein their questions can be widely used by other media outlets. Then, instead of providing an opportunity for a journalist to ask individual and unique questions and express a story of their own creation to their audience and readers, or listeners in this case, what an individual finds themselves in is a race against time before other news outlets report on their work. So in a situation such as this podcast, for example, I rely upon pro wrestling websites that report on news relating to the industry to give their audiences a heads up of the work that I provide here. Meaning, ideally, websites will pick up my interview with Chris Adonis from this episode. And the reason that that becomes crucial is because this content is exclusive to me. I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast that I am not a fan of conference calls. Have I done conference style interviews in the past? Absolutely. When I interviewed Jerry Seinfeld, for example, a number of years ago, when he was promoting his movie that was, you may recall it for some fans out there, it was titled The Bee Movie. It was an animated film about bees. I sat in on a group interview with Jerry Seinfeld. I met him in person. But the key in that was that I was there covering that film for LGBTQ publications. I was sitting in with other journalists who took an interest in the film because it was a children's film. So they were writing for parent publications. I was sitting in with journalists that were covering it for Jewish outlets because Jerry Seinfeld is Jewish, meaning that every individual who that sat in on that joint interview was writing with a different perspective in mind. Had I been sitting there with a variety of other journalists who were writing for the same audience I was, I would have been far less interested in that interview, number one. And number two, I would have been far less able to provide a unique and exclusive variety of content to the audiences for whom I was writing. As that relates to what I'll be presenting later in this episode, in fact, very shortly, which is my conference call interview with Alberto El Patron, I sat in a conference call with Alberto El Patron with every major and some minor, such as myself, media outlets that deal with professional wrestling. Every one of us were able to hear and record the questions that were directed towards Mr. Patron by every other journalist. As a result, the questions that I asked, or rather the question that I asked, as you will hear later in this episode, momentarily, has already been reported upon by every major news outlet. It defeated the purpose of my participation in the conference call. The best thing that came from the conference call, in my opinion, was being able to represent my point of view and my perspective as an LGBTQ journalist and fan of professional wrestling, as well as to be able to name check this podcast in a conference call which has been recorded and widely provided by every outlet in the professional wrestling industry. Several months ago, when Impact first invited me to participate in these conference calls, I pulled what may have come across as a bit of a diva move. I, first of all, stood up for myself in saying that I am not a journalist who writes specifically for a pro wrestling website. Now, this by no means is to slight the people who support what I do at these websites. What I'm saying is that I write for a news outlet, such as Huffington Post, from which most of the news outlets that are relating specifically to professional wrestling pull their content, meaning very seldom do professional wrestling websites write for a broader audience. They are specific to professional wrestling fans. And my work has the potential to reach a much broader audience when I'm writing it for Huffington Post. And once I provide the content to the Huff Post, then these websites will go over and quite often, without even attributing them to me, pull the quotes and use them for their fans, which if I were allowed the opportunity to write an article based on my perspective from an exclusive interview, then not only would Impact and the wrestlers themselves be able to reach my audience, then they would in turn reach the audience of strictly and exclusively professional wrestling fans that the websites, such as whatever websites, are going to reach. I initially declined the opportunity to sit in on these interviews because of what I have just outlined for you. It does me no good, and I will certainly not spend my personal time writing up an article on my question to Alberto El Patron from this conference call, because it's already been reported upon. There is no point. Furthermore, for anybody who has read that question on other websites, it discredits me as a journalist by looking like I am reporting what has already been reported and what many sites inaccurately reflect as their own question. So I'm not going to sit down and spend up to several hours writing out an expository, meaning a story, an expository feature from my question. Would I have written an article that would have been far greater in impact, so to speak, than what they're got, what they've achieved by this conference call, had I been given even 10 minutes on the phone alone with Alberto Alpatrone? Absolutely, because I would have had exclusive content. As it stands, that's not going to happen. Will I continue at this point to participate in these conference calls that Impact has set up? Probably so. As I said, it's good exposure for this podcast and for me to get my name out there to any who might listen to those interviews from the variety of websites that deal with professional wrestling. But in terms of my interest in the content and making it go further than including a snippet or two here and there on this podcast, it's really limited. Fortunately, it has been proven time and time again that while Impact may not be necessarily inclined to grant me one-on-one interviews with its superstars from a corporate perspective, the stars of Impact Wrestling recognize both my ability to write and provide interesting and detailed articles about their work, as well as an interest to self-promote, because Impact Wrestling is only signing people to these contracts which are good for a set number of appearances on their television product. It's not like Impact is signing wrestlers to go on tour. It's not like Impact is signing people to full-time contracts wherein they are working exclusively with Impact. They have written into their contracts the right to work in promotions around the world and to do work outside of Impact when they're not contracted to television taping schedules. So if, in fact, Impact is not going to help me secure these interviews with people like Alberto El Patron or even Chris Adonis, which I pursued and secured completely on my own, I will continue to do so exclusively for this podcast, exclusively for my listeners, and exclusively for my readers on Huffington Post. With that in mind, it is time now for us to take a quick break, and when we come back, I will provide you with a snippet of Alberto El Patron's recent conference call with the wrestling media, which took place this past Wednesday, wherein he discussed a wide array of subject matter as relates to Impact Wrestling, his return at Bound for Glory, and his thoughts on the future. I'm not going to provide you the entire 50-minute conversation that was had. You can find that elsewhere, on other podcasts, on wrestling websites. Just Google it if that's what you're interested in. I do include my own exclusive question, as well as two questions from my peers within the industry, and I will leave for you who they are, the outlets that they work for, out of respect for their work as journalists and out of respect for their participation in that conference call. I am Poyo Dalmar. You're listening to Arm Drag Takedown, and I will be back with more in just a moment.
Each and every episode of Arm Drag Takedown with Poyo Dalmar includes news, unique perspective on the world of professional wrestling, and recaps of what has happened on our favorite television products during the week. Plus, exclusive interviews with your favorite professional wrestlers from around the world. Never miss an action-packed episode of Arm Drag Takedown with Poyo Dalmar by following us on social media. On Facebook, it's facebook.com/ADT with PDM. That's ADT with PDM. And follow us on Twitter as well, ADT with PDM. If you'd like to follow our hostess, Poyo Dalmar, it's at the Glamazon PDM on Twitter. Arm Drag Takedown with Poyo Dalmar, your professional wrestling podcast with a slightly queer twist.
And we're back with more Arm Drag Takedown with Poyo Dalmar. As promised, we now go to a recent interview with Alberto El Patron. This was conducted on November 29th during a conference call arranged by Impact Wrestling with the professional wrestling media. I sat in with a variety of other journalists relating to professional wrestling, and included in this are questions from Sportskeeda, as well as the Daily Mirror in the United Kingdom, plus my own question. We now go in progress to an interview with Alberto Al Patrone.
Hi, Alberto. It's Neil here again from the Daily Mirror. I just wanted to ask you about Bound for Glory when you returned. You cut a promo criticising Impact Wrestling management for suspending you and stripping you of your title, despite all investigations into alleged domestic violence resulting in you being cleared of any wrongdoing. You also forced Jerry Barash to apologise for not reaching out to you when you were suspended. How do you feel about bringing these personal issues into Impact Wrestling and using them as part of the storyline?
Part of it was the storyline. Part of it was completely real. Everybody knows about the suspension, but we talked about this. The company and I talked about this, and we decided that it was the right thing to do at the moment, because when the whole drama happened, we didn't have the right evidence to prove the audience, the sponsors, the TV networks that I didn't do absolutely anything. So, in order to protect the company, the wrestlers in the company, and all the people working for it, we decided to do that. Same stuff with the title. The title stuff, it was me saying, hey, I think we should do something while I'm suspended, and I should not be the champion right now, because I want rules to apply the same way to every single member of Impact Wrestling. I was one of the ones, or one of the first three wrestlers in the other company, always screaming out loud, why rules apply for some wrestlers here and not for others? And I'm talking about the company WWE when I was there.
Yeah.
And so it would have been completely unfair from me to, just because I'm Alberto El Patron, say, oh, no, I'm going to remain the champion. No, if you have to preach with the example. I wanted to show the new talent and all my coworkers in Impact Wrestling it doesn't matter if I'm Alberto. And it doesn't matter that I didn't do absolutely anything, nothing. That everything was just something. That it was not real, that it was a complete lie, and it was just to protect or to not knowing what was going on. It doesn't matter. It looked wrong, and again, even though I didn't do absolutely anything, there's the standards that we have to follow, and I understand these days it's with social media, with the internet, it's different. We are under the microscope all the time, and that's why I decided to relinquish the title and to do it that way. But the company was supporting me, so it was just part of a storyline. I'm not angry. I'm not really angry to the company. It's part of the storyline, but I took that as a chance to throw some reality or the truth out there to remind people that all that they read, heard in the internet was just completely BS.
Hello, it's Poyo Delmar with Arm Drag Takedown and Huffington Post. And I was wondering if you could discuss the recent return of Paige to WWE.
Can you repeat that again, please?
Yes, I was wondering if you could discuss your thoughts on Paige's recent return to WWE television.
Oh, I mean, it's fantastic. It was just about time. I mean, it's just, I used to say this all the time, people forget that she had neck surgery, screws behind her neck, and that takes time. That's the reason why she was out of the business, and it takes time to recover from something like that. And then she started working really, really hard for her big comeback, and now she's there, and she's doing what she she's doing what she has been doing since the beginning of his career, of her career, or since the beginning of her career in WWE. She's killing it. She's doing a fantastic job, and I said it before, and I'm going to say it again. She has all the potential to be the most successful diva of all time. And, you know, just we have to give her time.
Hello, Alberto. This is Anirudh from Sportskeeda again. As we've seen with Bobby Lashley, we've found out that Impact Wrestling hasn't had too many problems sending people over to Bellator MMA. Since you have a background in the sport of mixed martial arts, would you consider stepping into this, into the cage for one last time? Possibly if the right offer came along?
Yes, of course. I was actually talking about this with my family last night while we were at that event, and in an event for to promote Combate Americas here in San Antonio this Friday. The first time I was out of WWE, I had the company Bellator reaching out to me to offer me something. The offer didn't make sense for me, and I didn't really want to do it. But then I met my great friend and boss, Campbell McLaren, and he came to me with a huge offer, a fantastic offer, and everybody knows it. And I even went back to the gym to get in fighting shape and everything, but I felt like it wasn't there anymore. My fighting spirit to fight inside the cage wasn't there anymore. And that's when I said, hey, amigo, I don't think I want to fight. I'm not hungry. For fighting in the cage anymore, but thank you. And then he ended up hiring me to do something else for the company. But in the past 3 months, as some people know, I've been training really hard. I'm getting back in an amazing shape. I'm in a really good place in my life, with a lot of projects, or more than projects, realities of my. Of projects or TV shows and stuff outside wrestling, and with good things going on in my wrestling career. So yes, I've been thinking about maybe doing one more fight. I'm not 100% sure right now. I might change my mind tomorrow or the next week, but right now, or last night, I was talking to my agent, lawyer, best friend, Keith McMahon, and I was telling him, hey, maybe I will do one more fight. But if that happens, he's definitely going to be with my company, Combate Americas. I would love to help my company to get that first pay-per-view. And if I'm going to go back inside the cage and trade punches and kick someone's trasero or get my trasero, okay, it has to be inside the Combate Americas cage.
And it's Pollo Del Mar once again. That, of course, was Alberto El Patron talking extensively about his return to Impact Wrestling. For any who are interested in hearing that interview in its entirety, Google Alberto El Patron teleconference, and you will find it available in its entirety all over the web. Which returns me to the earlier comments I made about why such things are not incredibly interesting to me. Since we have focused so heavily on content which is not exclusive, let's now go to this week's highlight for me, my personal interview with Impact Wrestling superstar Chris Adonis. As you probably remember, Chris Adonis debuted initially a number of years ago, over a decade ago, in WWE as Chris Masters. They built him as a superstar by allowing him to feature his Master Lock Challenge each week on their episodes, proving that his full Nelson was unbreakable. During the course of his career with WWE, he was featured in matches and programs with everyone from the top stars where he challenged for the World Heavyweight title, to his challenges for the Intercontinental title. He's worked with John Cena, who has declared that Chris Masters is probably the strongest wrestler he's ever stepped into the ring with, to his idol, Shawn Michaels, who we discussed during this interview. Currently on Impact Wrestling, Chris Adonis is a featured player in the global heavyweight championship scene as the sidekick and second hand to current global champion Eli Drake. On this week's Impact, he came out to the rescue of Eli Drake as he inserted himself into this week's match between Johnny Impact and the returning Alberto El Patron. As it turned out, the main event picture turned into a huge brawl between Impact, Patron, Drake, Adonis, and Petey Williams. It sets up for an exciting series of matches on upcoming television broadcasts, which have already been taped. I will not give you any spoilers for that, but do tune in now as we go to an exclusive interview with Mr. Chris Adonis. Well, thank you for joining me. I appreciate you coming and talking to me and giving me some insight about your career and what's going on with you in Impact Wrestling.
Yeah, no problem.
Earlier in my career, before I started this podcast, I had a chance to talk to Eli Drake about his character and how he's different from his character. And you're so closely associated with Eli. I was wondering what the difference between you and your on-screen persona are.
Well, like the masterpiece and Chris Adonis and all that is obviously a very vain guy and kind of really a narcissist and egotistical, which I guess I have some of those characteristics, but a lot of that is exaggerated for the sake of the character in television, and it's actually a lot more fun to try to be something, you know, it's like you're trying to play a part, right, or a role, and I find that when I'm trying to play something opposite of kind of what I am, it actually helps. But been said many times that it has to be extension of who you are, which I agree, and I think it is sort of extension and turning up my personality. But, you know, I don't by any means walk into every single place that I enter and think that I'm the greatest person that's ever walked in there, which is what Chris Masters or the Adonis or whatever would think as a character. So, you know, that's kind of the challenge of it, is overcoming just any kind of doubts about yourself or anything like that you have, and not portraying that when you walk out in front of people, you know what I mean? And just coming out there with the utmost confidence and no insecurities and just becoming that guy, essentially.
I read in a previous interview that you have expressed frustration in the past that people just think of you as a bodybuilder, and with a character that is so based on your physical appearance and your physical build, why is that an incorrect perception, and what have you done throughout your career to try to change that perception?
Well, I worked really hard, especially my second WWE run. I mean, a lot of it was kind of lost on superstars, but Dirty Betty, who had seen it, and CM Punk even referenced it after I was released. I just worked real hard on becoming the best in-ring talent I possibly could, you know, because I've always, the only reason I kind of resent, I think, that whole persona is because it's kind of identified with a lot of guys who didn't necessarily love the business or care about the business and kind of exploited it and just took advantage of it and made a bunch of money and, you know, were kind of thrown down wrestling fans' throats. Where, you know, I rather, you know, grew up on it, loved it my whole life. It's all I ever wanted to do. So it wasn't just a cash grab, or I didn't just jump over because I was a big guy from bodybuilding. I actually started training in the gym, training as a bodybuilder, an athlete, just when I was 16 and I decided I wanted to pursue pro wrestling. So I think to answer your question, that's really where it comes from. It's just what's identified with that type of character, that type of person in the business, which is everything I just explained to you. But that was actually a really good question, because nobody's really kind of phrased it to me like that. And that kind of got to dug a few layers in, and we found out what that's really about.
I definitely could understand why it is that falling into that category. I mean, I think that we look at pro wrestling and everything is built on archetypes, right? There's either the flamboyant showman, or there's the high flyer, or there's the bodybuilder, or the, you know, the big guy, however you want to look at it. And I think that for a person who falls into a category that may not necessarily be considered one of the more flattering, like a bodybuilder, throughout history we've seen guys that had limited abilities, but we've always heard about that look that WWE loves, for example. And you might have had the benefit of that.
They're usually clunky, and they usually don't move around well, and they're usually not identified with working well, you know? So there's also those perceptions of that, right? So I think that's kind of what you're alluding to, too, a little bit.
Right. I mean, it's not one of the most flattering I think that it certainly can be used to diminish people's actual talents or abilities or their value that got them perhaps signed to begin with. If people assume, I mean, we look, for example, complete extreme of that would be the divas in the past where, you know, these women who were super gorgeous and they fit the mold that people wanted to see in the ring show up, they take spots from people who can actually wrestle and they don't have any value other than beauty. And you're looked at as the male equivalent by some.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense.
I read that early in your career with WWE, after you were signed, you were told to study and emulate Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff. And I still think, to some degree, that perhaps some of what you studied of him still shows up in your character. And I was wondering if you think that that's true.
Well, yeah. And to touch on that a little more, actually, they did actually have me work with Paul himself, Mr. Wonderful, at WrestleMania 21. He was out there in L.A., so we actually had used the ring, him and myself, for, I think about 3 or 4 times training. So they actually went as far as to even have me work with him. And I remember at that point, his work he missed me a lot on. One thing that he had outside of just being, you know, a great character in terms of being Mr. Wonderful and his whole presentation and whatnot was he was a very intense worker. You know what I mean? He's really good at turning it up and being, you know, just turning up that intensity and really bringing it to guys, which is kind of what he was working on me with. You know, I think at that point in my career, I was probably a little too green, a little too much of a rookie to kind of even understand how to, you know, get to that point yet. You know, I was working a lot more on just the fundamentals, learning how to execute and, you know, not forgetting stuff and all that, which is kind of where, for my trajectory, I mean, that's where a lot of guys usually are at that point. So it would have probably been a lot more beneficial working with Paul a little bit later, but I'm not going to say, obviously, that I didn't learn anything from him because I did, and he was great. Yeah, I mean, from the minute Vince saw me, that I think that was the comparison that he made with me, and, you know, so that was definitely kind of what they were wanting me to emulate or at least study.
Right. Well, I mean, in terms of a guy who had a long-term impact in the industry and unfortunately never even held a WWE title, Paul Orndorff is pretty much at the top of the heap of people that you could be compared to.
Yeah, definitely.
And speaking of legends, I know that in the middle portion of your career, you went and worked with Harley Race at the World League Wrestling. And I was wondering, as a longtime fan of Harley's, if you could share some memories of working with such an icon.
Oh my God. He was the best. And then rest in peace, his deceased ex-wife, BJ, was amazing. I just learned a lot about the business, not necessarily just in the ring, but also just the hustle of it outside of the ring when you're not working for WWE or any big company, or, you know, when you're just working the independent wrestling, so to speak, which, you know, there's a lot of hustling that goes on there, you know, selling your stuff, your pictures. It's like you're really your own business at that point, as compared to, you know, WWE, which they say you are, but you're kind of really on their terms and their schedule, whatever they want you to do. So it was just great. They really welcomed me in. Harley would constantly be, you know, encouraging me or giving me advice. Same thing with DJ, as far as the business and whatnot and how to handle it. And I mean, they even had me over at their house to stay over on the lake. And, you know, because he's real big into boats, right? He has a boat over there and everything. So, you know, he just could have been a more welcoming, nice guy and just a great guy for me at that point in my career to be around in terms of just having, you know, good male influence kind of around for me. You know, because I was kind of right after, like you said, after my first departure in WWE. And, you know, it was good to have some guidance in my life at that point, just because, you know, I was still really young for everything that had happened to me at that point. So, you know, a lot of it was overwhelming, and, you know, I had to find my way back around that time.
It's interesting to note because so many people only know of Harley Race for his tenure in WWF at the time. And, of course, I was a fan of the NWA long before WWF was even...
Yeah, I was going to say, you watched him back when he was there and all that. Yeah, how long was his run in WWE? It wasn't too long. Most of his I think his key win was NWA, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, he held all of his championships in the NWA and throughout the South. Yeah. I mean, I was aware of his work in places like the National Wrestling Alliance in Missouri and the areas throughout Georgia. So he had a huge impact throughout those areas. And it was only towards the end of his career, after he was sadly pretty much past his prime, you know, once he had passed the torch to Ric Flair in NWA is when he went to the WWF at that time. And they made him the king and all of the things that people generally know about Harley Race, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, most of the memories are in NWA.
Yeah, and I think that for a person who is in that position that you're describing, when you become an independent wrestler, because you'd never really had that experience prior to WWF. I mean, you went into WWE, and that was your beginnings, but I can't imagine a person to be a better mentor for what it's like to be a journeyman type of professional wrestler and run your own business in that industry than him.
Oh, yeah. I must say that I think I started working for him pretty soon after my release in WWE, and it was, I didn't really realize it at the time, or maybe I did a little bit at least, but it really just got me ready for just the independent wrestling world in general. You know, I got to work with, I mean, not your typical indies, but I mean, you had some good talent around there. At least, yeah, they were really training, obviously, because they were with Harley Race's promotion and school. So, you know, just getting to work some of those guys over there. And, you know, a lot of those guys worked to that style, too, from NWA, you know, that old school style, but, you know, really kind of easy type storytelling, you know, not as much of hardcore indie fan style. You know, like I said, just for the business aspect of it, too, just for a multitude of reasons. It was just, I was in the right place at the right time and where I needed to be at that juncture.
During the course of your career, from the very beginning, you've had the opportunity to step into the ring with the best in the world today, to be honest. And I was wondering if there is a wrestler out there that you've had your eye on that you would love to compete against but have never had the opportunity.
Well, that's a good question. Who was I just... Well, I remember, this is long before Owens went to WWE, but I remember I watched him over in England work one match, and I was kind of in awe of what he did, and I was trying to get the promoter in England, Stephen Flutter, who runs PCW, and you were right outside of Manchester and Preston in the UK,
mm-hmm.
And so I saw Owens, he's Dean at the time, and I thought he was a tremendous talent. I was just thinking, wow, I could have great matches with him, because like some of my best matches I had over there about 3 years ago, a lot of them were against like Chris Travis and various other talent over there in the UK, but they've just got a crap load of good talent, good wrestlers who really are just fundamentally really sound and just really execute well with everything and tell a great story and great fans too. Another guy that I think who's doing really well that I've noticed who's on the rise, I don't know if he's necessarily a guy that I want to work right away or anything. I mean, not to say I wouldn't like to work him either, but Matt Riddle seems like a guy who's pretty funny and up-and-comer in terms of the business from what I can see. So I'm kind of excited to see what he can do. And, you know, there's other guys, obviously. I've seen so many within the last few years.
The great thing, I think, about working on the indie circuit is that you get exposure to wrestlers all over the world. You've toured Australia and New Zealand and throughout Europe and the United States, and it just exposes you to such a breadth of talent that you would never have the opportunity to step into the ring with or even interact with if you were signed to a company that did not allow for that in your contract.
Oh, yeah, but that works both ways. That's for better or for worse sometimes, you know, as you can imagine, because, you know, as much as people want to look at some of the people in WWE and be like, oh, this guy can't work or that guy can't work, the fact of the matter is whether they can work or not, every guy up there is at least an athlete. And even if they can't work, they're probably a top-level athlete, you know what I mean? Or if they can't work by a smart march, quote-unquote, wrestling standard,
yeah.
You know, they're top athletes, so... You know, the problem is some of the guys you'll find on the indies obviously are usually weekend warriors, and this is nothing to put them down or anything like that, but, you know, they work regular jobs and stuff like that, so, I mean, they're
whole life isn't necessarily committed to pro wrestling, so when it comes around to doing it on the weekend, they're not always in the best of shape. If when we're talking better or worse, that's obviously on the worse side. But for the better, I mean, you just got a lot of hungry guys out there, obviously, who all want to go out there and steal the show every time they work, regardless of which match they are, whether it's first, third, fourth, fifth, or main event, which, you know, can be a great thing. You know, it's great to have a chip on your shoulder, want to make a name for yourself. But, you know, honestly, a lot of guys need to understand, too, that you have to respect the card. And, you know, you can't be in the first match and go out there and do, you know, throw everything at them and then they, you know, but the kitchen sink, essentially, when you got a main event at the end that you have to respect, right? So
is that what you described as something that happens often? I mean, I've never really thought about it that way because the people in the industry that I know always want to put on the best show possible. They always want to put on the best match possible, but I never really thought about the fact that putting on the best match possible should probably come within context, right? Like the best opening match possible.
Yes. That's right. You put it perfectly right there, within context. That doesn't mean you go out there in the first match or the third match, you go 30 minutes and you do a million different moves and false finishes and go to the outside and dive, because the thing is, there's a psychology to a card. You know what I mean? It's all one show. So, I mean, if you have multiple matches doing that, you end up having a four and a half hour show. You go too long, and then the main event has nothing left to do. So a lot of times, I mean, it's easy for me to say because I've already been to WWE too, so I understand that these guys are trying to make a name for themselves, or, you know, some guys just have a chip on their shoulder, you know, and they want to prove themselves or whatever. You know what I mean? I come in, like you just said a minute ago, it's a little different for me because I started in WWE, so I come in and I don't have as much of that going on. You know what I mean? It's more to me, it's like, okay, where am I at on the card? And, you know, based off that, you know, I know what it is kind of we need to accomplish at that point. And, you know, if you're going on before the main event, you need to understand you're going on before the main event, and you need to, that means that there's changes, obviously, to make. And, but it's like you said, it's, you know, doesn't mean you have to hold somebody back or they can't have a good match, but, you know, a lot of guys just need to remember within the context of the show, like you said, what that means. And successful show isn't just, it's kind of like a team effort, you know. It's like, at the end of the day, you know, yeah, your match can be great, but, you know, you want the whole show to be a success so people come back and everything. But, you know, like I said, it's easy for me to say from my standpoint, which is very different. You know, if I hadn't gone to WWE first and I was on the Indies, I'm sure I would have a lot of that going on too, you know, because, I mean, what else are you supposed to do? And, you know, also just your mentality, it takes you a while to learn that you don't have to go 20 plus minutes and do a million things to have a great match. You know, it takes a while to understand that, I think, as a worker, because a lot of people within the 3 to 4, 5, 6 year range just think that that's what it entails, you know, which really kind of doesn't. You know, you learn as time goes on, you can do it within the context of the show and the match that you're in.
Well, I just learned not that long ago this concept of getting your shit in. Some guy was like, I'm going to get my shit in when I'm out there. And I was like, what does that mean? He's like, I'm going to do everything. Basically, everything I'm capable of doing is going to happen. To me, I didn't even think that sounded like a great idea. I mean, I look as a viewer and watch certain matches, and every time I see people presumably getting their shit in, I'm like, okay, I've seen this so many times. It's not surprising or interesting anymore.
Yeah, you know, again, that's kind of those things that, I mean, I agree with you, but it's debatable in terms of, like, you have a guy that I know, and you probably know him too, Brian Cage, for instance. He's actually, his name is Mr. GMSI, Get My Shit In.
Yes.
So, various times when I've worked with him, or at least I've seen him work, I mean, I've felt like he probably does too much. But at the same time, when you put Mr. Get My Shit in your name, you know what I mean? And it becomes part of your gimmick. And also when you're working in front of some of the audiences he has, when you go to like Ring of Honor, for instance, to some of these shows, these audiences are kind of conditioned for that. You know what I mean? It's high volume, high offense. It's like, you know, pile driver is not enough, then I got to go up to the top rope and hit him with a 450 type shit, which psychology wise No, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't really correlate with, you know, it won't really get over to the big audience, I don't think, because it's not necessarily good storytelling. Because, you know, if you can't beat them with a pile driver and then a moonsault or a 450 right after that, it's like, what does that really say about your offense? And then, like, what are you going to finish them with? If you can't finish them with that, is the finish going to be a roll-up? Kind of lame, you know what I mean? You want the finish to the highest point. So you can argue both ways. I mean, obviously, I stand on that side of the argument that, you know, it's just kind of more wasted offense, and you want, the point of pro wrestling is to make everything matter as much as possible, you know, just to make the simple things matter, like make a DDT matter, make a super kick matter. But like I said, you got to know your audience as well. And that goes into the other side of the argument. It's like, if, you know, the audience has already been conditioned to this third volume of stuff, a lot of, you know, get your shit in type offense, then you got to know that. So, or at least, you know, these guys are aware of it and they play to it. And, you know, I can't really argue with that, because you can't just turn around and just give them a master lock, Cole Nelson, and think that they're going to necessarily be, at least overnight, they won't be conditioned to liking that. You know what I mean? You have to be conditioned and trail back from that stuff, which is kind of what WWE did with me, essentially, when I came in, is they were trying to take a step back from doing all the crazy stuff or doing the, you know, and just get them conditioned more back to some basic stuff that's fundamental and just works, like a full Nelson, which is a simple hold, but it works well. And if it's presented right, and like the way they did with the Master Lock Challenge, people buy into it.
Right. In terms of Brian Cage, I actually love watching him in the ring. I've interviewed him. I think he's an incredible worker, and I think that guys who have that getting their shit in mentality are fine in doses, right? But I feel like, and maybe it sounds like you would tend to agree with me, I think that because the fans are conditioned at this point to expect everything but the kitchen sink in a match, that so few moves actually have any power whatsoever, or they don't have the power that they used to. I mean, when Jake Roberts hit the DDT, you knew it was done. You know, the match was over, and if it wasn't, you were shocked. Hulk Hogan's leg drop, the same thing. I mean, you could go through the history of wrestling and know that these were major finishing moves, and now people do what used to be finishing moves all the time as part of their regular offense, and nothing ever seems to have the impact it used to.
Well, yeah, and that's part of the problem. But, I mean, I don't know if WWE is necessarily doing that to that extent. I mean, they always tried to at least protect and not, you know, do as much as the hardcore audiences that you're talking about, or the, you know, the internet fans, so to speak. But, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, it's just, it is what it is. You know, it's just some fans have been conditioned to a different style. You know, I mean, really, when you think about it, or a different genre. It's just really kind of what, you know, what you like. What's your taste in pro wrestling? Is it more storytelling, or is it acrobatic and, you know, spotty, you know, necessarily? Because, you know, usually those matches tend to be not as great in terms of the storytelling. And, you know, it's just usually offense, 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 offense. And, you know, that, you know, you lose something in that. You know, you don't have those great moments when you're just constantly doing stuff. You know, you don't have, like, you know, some of the great moments, like Shawn Michaels has produced at WrestleMania, just through storytelling, not even through loops. I mean, you know, like, Shawn is a good example of a guy who many consider probably the best worker in the business, but when you look at his offense, I mean, did he really do anything that innovative or, you know, or outside the box? Not really, just everything he did really well, and he was a great storyteller and a great seller. So, I mean, you know, you put all that together and, you know, you realize that it doesn't really matter, you know, how innovative the move or whatnot. It just matters really, you know, the performance overall, so to speak. You know, that means not only do you have great moves that you execute, but you execute the right emotions at the right time. You execute, you know, all those little things. And, you know, that's in the storytelling aspect, which goes along with the emotions of what's happened and, you know, you're selling and how you're able to bring a crowd into it or convey pain and all that kind of stuff. All the little technical things that, you know, kind of the in-between stuff, as I like to say. You know, wrestling isn't just really wrestling. It's theater is what it is.
You had an early program with Shawn Michaels, and it sounds like you really enjoyed that. I every interview that you've done kind of touches on him in some way. Was he really instrumental in developing or helping you develop as a personality and to understand the business as well?
Well, I grew up idolizing him, first of all. So, I mean, yeah, just the fact that I got to work him was huge for me, obviously. You know, it's just like, you know, getting to work a childhood hero. Not many people get to do that, so it's just the most surreal thing ever. And, yeah, he was instrumental because he really brought my confidence along at that point. After I got to work him one time, he allowed me and gave me the freedom to be able to, you know, kind of quarterback our matches and call our matches outside of just the very finish. So, you know, I'd go out there and just being able to work with a guy who like that, of that talent, and him have the trust to call the whole match, you know, kind of take the leadership role in it, and me be able to pull it off was all very... It's something I really needed at that point because it was very difficult to have good, you know, great matches, if, let alone even good matches with guys who were of my talent or, you know, even lesser at that point. It was just, you know, I couldn't necessarily carry a match, and, you know, it was hard even with guys that were of my talent. But, you know, when I got in there with a guy like Sean or any kind of those guys from the generation up or that had the experience in that were just really good at, you know, working in the ring, it was much easier. But, I mean, also with those guys, the crowd was very invested in them, too, so that's also part of that.
Oh, yeah, I can only imagine the kind of adrenaline rush it is to work in a match where the audience is so invested in your opponent, because even if you're not overly established at that point in time, they're really, really invested in the outcome for your opponent. And when you get in with somebody like a Shawn Michaels or any of the other people, I mean, I know that you're good friends with Randy Orton, too. And, I mean, Randy has reached a place where the fans are invested in him in a similar capacity, I think.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, and Cena and all those guys, for sure, yeah.
So when you first came into Impact and you started partnering with Eli Drake, I thought they might move you guys in the direction of a tag team. They've got you certainly working in tag team matches, but I thought it might be something a little more formal. And I was wondering why it is that it didn't go that direction for you. Was it because they had bigger plans for Eli, or what was your sense of that?
I think everything's just been moving. There's just been a lot of inconsistency over the last few months. You know, I think everybody kind of knows it in terms of Impact. So, I mean, I don't think anybody's really known from month to month what necessarily was going on. But I do know it's at some point or another they did decide to roll with Eli in terms of just giving him a push. And, you know, I mean, when you look at Eli, he's been there for a while. He's worked really hard to be where he's at. So you can't really argue with that. And, also, I mean, I'm sure he's one of the guys who's still, you know, from the previous ownership, so to speak, and all that, I'm still under the contracts. So, I mean, you know, I'm sure there's a multitude of reasons for that. But, I mean, I think at the very most, I mean, if you look at Eli, at least what I've seen over the last few months and what he's done before that, it's just he's been kind of a homegrown talent in Impact, and he's really worked hard to get where he's at. And, you know, people start really starting to react to him. So it's kind of the right time for them to be doing something with him. And I think he's done a good job with it, too. So, I mean, I can't really argue with it. I mean, I see a lot of potential in what we can do together and apart, obviously, in the future in terms of just everything, just progression of our characters and progression of you know, him going in one direction, me going another, and, you know, even now for the next few months, while we're still together, just kind of what we can do in terms of our chemistry and whatnot. So, I don't know, you know, everything, as long as I've been in Impact, has been, you know, nothing's been set in stone, everything's been questionable. We've had a lot of moving pieces and a lot of people in and out, so, you know, it's just about getting the company to a stable place again, really, at this point. You know, it seems like we're doing now.
I've got acquaintances, professional acquaintances, people I've interviewed many times who work with Impact, and it seems that I also want to present up front that I'm not trying to say anything negative about Impact because I actually really enjoy the product. I'm rooting for the product. I want the company to succeed. But it definitely feels like for people who've been around a while, there has to be an emotional toll that comes with that same feeling that the viewers get, which is like, oh, here we go again. Something new, a new restart, a new focus, a new direction. That's the one thing that is really holding them back is a lack of long-term goals that they want to achieve and a team that's in place that's going to get them there.
Oh, well, I mean, those are definitely all very good points, and I can't say I disagree with them. But there's nothing that's really in my hands at this point or with the company or anybody else's, right? It's just, it's gone through basically a change of management and or cabinet, so to speak, within the last 6 months a few times. So, you know, all you can hope now is you got Scott D'Amore, Sanjay Dutt, and, you know, Ed, who's the owner, actually, or with the Fight Network, and you just hope that they can kind of stick with that for a minute and get some consistency, and those guys can do a good job, which they have so far in terms of just, you know, taking over the wheel and, you know, and obviously adjust the partner.
So I was going to ask you, we were talking about Eli. When I've been watching some of Eli's more recent promos, I really get a sense that he has been sitting down watching old Ric Flair promos.
Oh, yeah, right. I told him the same thing. Yeah, he's got a kind of nature boy thing going on.
Oh, absolutely. It's like, I told the girls to meet me over at the Doubletree, but only if they've got a double D.
Yeah, is that what he said?
Yeah, something like that.
That's good.
So,
yeah, I've noticed that too, very much so.
I was thinking that might be an indication that they're going to take you guys in a direction akin to something closer to maybe a horseman type of angle, which would, I think both of you guys might be well suited for, to partner up with another team or something like that and increase the numbers in your collective. Is that something that's on the horizon?
Well, it sounds like a good idea to me, now that you mention it. It's definitely, who am I going to be in that chair? Am I the enforcer? Am I the Barry Windham, maybe? Or the, let's see, how many different versions of Four Horsemen do we have out there?
Right. Well, I think that if we went with a classic, if you added a tag team, that would make you probably like the Lex Luger from one of the...
Oh, yeah. Who was in that one? That was Luger and... Was it...
Tully and Arn, Luger and Flair.
Okay. Yeah, yeah,
so it was the cool tag team of Tully and Arn with Luger. And the reason that I suggested that is because the storyline for that was that Luger was a threat to Flair, so they added him to the Horsemen to keep him under wraps.
Oh, that's what it was. That's right. Because I remember I started watching WCW right after around that time, but I remember I got the figures. And that was the first Four Horsemen I had seen, was the Sid, the Andersons, and Flair, that version of them. And then I learned about the Barry Windham one. And then, I had to play a lot of catch-up on some of the WCW because I just became aware of it at, like, 1991, I think, is when I first turned it on. But I was obviously very taken by it because I had seen Rick Rude and I wondered where he went, and then Sting for the very first time.
Well, the Flair, the Barry Windham was version 3. The Barry Windham addition to the Four Horsemen was, in my opinion, the best version. So with Tully, Arn, Barry, Rick, and J.J. Dillon, the best version.
Yeah.
Now, where do you see your character and personality going as TNA? I'm so ingrained in me. Sorry. As Impact keeps moving forward.
I think there's a lot of room, obviously, to do a lot more with Eli, but then there's a lot of room for us to do something in terms of the split, you know, maybe hopefully something different. But, that's all something to look to, like, long-term planning, to go back to what you were saying. You know, it's something that you'd want to have in the long-term plans and have a direction and something that can benefit both of us. You know, that can be a tool to, you know, send Eli into his baby face run and send me into a heel run or something essentially like that where, you know, all this can be for a reason at the end of the day and help both characters evolve into something else and branch out, so to speak.
Yeah, I think that right now that they are almost reaching a tipping point with Eli's character, because what happens is when somebody plays a heel so well that they get catchphrases that catch on with the audience and things of that nature, is that slowly they either have to turn them face intentionally, or it's going to happen without their efforts at all.
Yeah, and that goes exactly to what I'm saying. I mean, I think essentially, I could be the tool for that. And, we might be able to do something really interesting and cool out of that. Kind of like they did with Sid and Sean back in the day, for example, or any one of those kind of situations. But, obviously there's just a lot of room to, write for that. And there's a lot of different ideas and a lot of different ways to do it. But it can be done very cool, And it can be done very not cool. So it's just, it's definitely something to think about in exactly the kind of the context you were just putting it, and where he needs to go, and obviously where I need to go.
Having started your career with WWE, it has certainly opened a lot of doors for you, and we talked about the fact that, for example, you don't have to do some of the things that people on the indie circuit may feel the need to do to make a name for themselves. But when you come into an environment like an Impact or other larger kind of national or international entities, does it feel like there's a bit of a stigma for you? Because, you talk about Eli as a homegrown talent, and even though your career probably didn't reach its absolute heights of where you are able to go in WWE, you are still really well known for that. And I was wondering if there's if that's a hurdle to overcome.
Well, I guess. I mean, I don't know. Some people just think you like their WWE guy, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. I don't know. It's an interesting question. Maybe there's a stigma to that, but I mean, if there is, I don't really care, right? Because that's essentially the top of the mountain. That's where you want to go. That's where you want to be, or you should want to be if you're a pro wrestler, because there's no higher mountain than that. I don't care what you say or who you stack against. I mean, that's it. That's the place that solidifies you all over the world, not just domestically, but internationally. Can potentially make you a household name. Just a guy that wrestling fans, hardcore wrestling fans, can recognize, which essentially is kind of what's taking over the business now, for the most part. I mean, I think you only have, I think pro wrestling has lost so much of casual or mainstream audience, and has probably been devoured so much by just the hardcore wrestling fans. And that's for, again, better or for worse. It gives a lot of those opportunities that you might not have seen 10 years ago, but at the same time, it might turn off the general audiences a little bit, because, they don't know who these guys are, and, the general person is wondering why there's a guy out there who looks like a kid, who's acting like he can whoop somebody's ass.
Yeah, no, I think that you're right. I do think
that might be drifting into a whole other topic, but, it's just something to be noticed about pro wrestling today, too. It's like, who's primarily watching it. And it's nothing against hardcore wrestling fans. Man, I was a hardcore wrestling fan, but, you always got to be thinking of that middle audience. It's just like a president. He can't just think of his base or the left or the right. I mean, he's got to be thinking about, the consensus or the center, and gearing towards that, because that's really where your bulk is, That's where you can always cater to the right or the left, or the wrestling guys are always going to kind of be there, They're always going to be there.
Right. I definitely think that, people who are fans of wrestling are always going to watch wrestling, whether it's good or bad. And unfortunately, there are times when things that, as a longtime fan of professional wrestling, I'm not really fond of, but I recognize that it does expand the viewer base, for example. And that's something that somebody who's running a national or international weekly televised product needs to be aware of. Like, is this going to expand our viewer base?
Yeah, exactly. It's just all stuff to think about, It's not demonizing anybody or anything. Like I said, I've always loved pro wrestling. I would be one of those guys too, but, you gotta think of, when was wrestling at its peak? It was when Hulk Hogan, Stone Cold, The Rock, kind of all on top, and, just that kind of personality that's kind of grabbed the masses, and created something bigger than even wrestling, right? And brought it to a whole other level.
Well, Chris, thank you for talking today. I appreciate it. And how can people find you on all of your social media?
Chris Masters 310 on Instagram. I think it's Chris Adonis on Twitter. For bookings and whatnot, masterpiece83@gmail.com.
Well, I appreciate you being accessible to us and stopping in to talk with me. I wish you the best of luck. Oh, by the way, what the hell with the turkey outfit? Come on now. I forgot. I almost.
I don't write the show, man. I said the same thing as soon as it happened.
Well, the bright side is that 20 years from now, if Impact is still broadcasting, every Thanksgiving they're going to do a recap, and you will be seen getting put in a turkey suit. I mean,
oh my goodness. Yeah, when I found out about that, I said the same thing, believe me.
Yeah, you are the gobbledygooker 2017.
All right, man. Thank you for the interview. I appreciate it.
All right. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
I'll take care.
All right, listeners, that was Chris Adonis. You can catch him each and every week currently on Impact Wrestling on Pop TV. He is involved heavily in the main event picture. I would love, as he and I discussed, I would love to see them build out a Four Horsemen style stable or set of wrestlers in Impact Wrestling. If you are a follower of this podcast on Twitter, tweet me at ADT with PDM and let me know who you think would be great partnered with Eli Drake, the global champion, and Chris Adonis if they were to build a stable like the Horsemen. I have some ideas of my own, and I will give those to you next week. But in the meantime, I would really enjoy hearing some feedback from you. If you are a listener and you've enjoyed one of our past interviews, please, by all means, reach out to me on social media. I would love, and I always appreciate and enjoy the opportunity to interact with the listeners and the general public, whether that be supporters of this podcast or just people in general. I am very active on my social media. You can follow me at the Glamazon PDM on Twitter. Speaking of which, I want to give a quick shout out to one of our followers on the Facebook page. That's facebook.com/ADT with PDM. Thank you, Darren Granter, for calling me to task on repeatedly misreferencing Survivor Series as SummerSlam on a back episode, or a series of back episodes, as it turns out. I am a dumbass. That's really what it comes down to. I don't know what happened there. As I told Darren on our Facebook page, and as I will let you know as listeners, quite often, today is an exception, but quite often, I'm recording this podcast in the middle of the night. This is a one-woman show, if you will, a one-person show, and I not only record, edit, and produce it, I'm the only one who's here to blame, so I will take 100% of the blame for misspeaking as such. And Darren, no, you're not a jerk for pointing it out to me. I appreciate it. I appreciate you listening. I appreciate you letting me know that I have done something that I can address and, you know, apologize for here on the air, as well as make sure it doesn't happen going forward. So if you are a listener out there and you don't agree with my opinion, please let me know. Tweet me. Send me a message on Facebook. Comment on our Facebook page. But whatever source you take, I do want you to know that your feedback is valued and will help make this podcast continue to get better as it grows. I'm no stranger to the podcasting world, but this is my first foray into professional wrestling-related material in the audio format, so I thank you for that. Letting you know, we have some big things in store for next episode. I cannot confirm. I thought there was a particular guest I would have on this episode, but as it turns out, not the case. So ideally, fingers crossed, that's a hint for you, he will be on next episode. But I can tell you that one of the people who is likely to be appearing not on the next episode, but on the episode after, is Jeff Cobb. Jeff Cobb is the current All-Pro Wrestling Universal Champion, and he is a superstar in the Lucha Underground scene. He wrestles there under a mask as Dario Cueto's brother, the masked monster Matanza Cueto, and is a former Lucha Underground champion. I'm hoping to have him on in two episodes. He is currently on tour in Japan. So when he returns on the 11th of December, I'm going to set that up for you. Until next week, you guys, happy December, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. Go ahead and stick a fork in me, honey, because like this episode, I'm done.